Welcome to the Spotlight Edition of the Future of Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Wright. Join me as I have conversations with fascinating medical experts as we discuss a variety of compelling topics. We aim to not only inform you, but to empower you, instilling confidence along your journey toward optimal health. This podcast is brought to you by Brentwood MD. Located just south of Nashville, Tennessee, Brentwood MD provides best-in-class concierge primary care. To learn more about our innovative approach to primary care, visit our website at brentwoodmd.com. On this Spotlight Edition, I'm excited to be joined by Brooke Fault. Brooke is a doctor of nursing practice and an expert in women's sexual and pelvic health, as well as menopause management. She founded the Women's Institute for Sexual Health in 2005 and served as its director at Urology Associates in Nashville for 18 years. A fellow of the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health and a certified menopause practitioner through the Menopause Society, she has significantly impacted the field through research, publications, and lectures. Brooke has held numerous positions on influential boards and even lobbied Congress for the FDA approval of ADDI, the first medication for hypoactive sexual desire disorder. Her multiple accolades include awards such as the William Oxley Thompson Award and Nashville Business Journal's 40 Under 40. She has been a practicing nurse practitioner since 2003 and remains on faculty with Vanderbilt University. She joined Pizona MD in 2024 as their Director of Women's Health. In the first portion of our conversation, we'll address prominent myths surrounding female sexual health, then we'll explore ways for women to manage low libido in the context of hypoactive sexual desire disorder. We hope you enjoy. Brooke, thank you so much for joining me on this Spotlight Edition of our podcast. As you and I have spoken off camera, I am really excited to sit down with you. The impact you've made on so many ladies that I've worked with over my roughly decade in Nashville has been so impactful. So thank you for that. And I am really selfishly excited about learning from you during this conversation. So thanks for taking the time.
I appreciate you having me. This is going to be a fun conversation.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. And as you kind of introduce yourself to our audience, just tell us a little bit about kind of what led you into women's health and specifically women's sexual health.
Yeah. Well, my background is, you know, I trained in women's sexual or just women's health in general, and then I always had an interest in subspecialty care, and I seemed to really gravitate towards the areas of underserved women's health care, which were kind of urogynecology, women's sexual health, pelvic floor disorders, vulvar dermatology, hormone disorders, basically everything that nobody else wants to do, and so it kind of worked out for me, and so I made it a hodgepodge practice for myself over the years. So what started as just a sex medicine practice within a large urology practice 20-ish years ago, I was only 12, by the way.
Of course, yes,
I was a student prodigy. But it just kind of morphed into, you know, treating other areas of women's healthcare that I felt weren't properly addressed, or that I felt that my colleagues in medicine really didn't have the proper time to manage. And so, you know, they really just wanted me to care for these patients, and then I would ship them back for their routine primary care or routine gynecology care or whatever it was that they were seeing them for.
That's great. Well, and some of those things you even mentioned, the subspecialties there, I know that's such underserved in the community because so many ladies maybe don't even bring certain things up, or they don't have the providers to really help them address certain things. So it's nice to have somebody who is passionate about reaching those people. And as we kind of talk more about hormone health and sexual health, just in general, why do you think that's such an important conversation for us to have? As ladies kind of consider their general health picture and then break it down into their female, women's, and sexual health.
Well, I think that I was just talking to a patient about this just a couple of hours ago. Hormone health, like it specifically, you know, if we're talking about menopause, for instance, you know, we can talk about hormone health in any age of a woman, starting with puberty. My goodness, having younger children, we understand how puberty goes, right?
Yes.
However, a large sector of my patient population is menopausal patients or perimenopausal patients. And we didn't used to live this long, but we've used modern medicine and our big brains to extend our lives to the point where women are now living in a significant portion of our lives in a postmenopausal era. And this is a new, I don't want to say problem, but a new issue that we're having to deal with as healthcare providers to, and also as women to, or the patients that I see, to deal with the symptoms associated with menopause. And unfortunately, what we tend to do in healthcare when we don't understand something, we kind of brush it under the rug or ignore it or just kind of, you know, pat our patients on the head and say, oh, you'll be fine. Women have dealt with this for years. And it's really, in my opinion, it's not the best way to, you know, to care for our patients or to just deal with something. And so knowing that we're living this significant portion of our lives, women, I think, deserve the right to feel good and to enjoy those years. And it's such an easy fix to have basic conversations and to come up with a individualized approach. And I think that's really what's important. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach to treating hormone disorders or hormonal complaints. It doesn't always involve hormones. There may be alternative options, but there are options. And yeah. I think just giving women a right to speak up, knowing that there are places that they can go where healthcare providers are familiar with these symptoms and treatment options, I think is really empowering. And knowing they don't have to suffer in silence.
Yeah, I think that's great to kind of consider. Not only should the patients be comfortable talking about these mm-hmm. symptoms or issues, but also I think providers have so much to learn. I know mm-hmm. I can speak to the first 8 years of my career where my knowledge of menopause and hormone management was about as tall as this water bottle. And I feel so terrible for some of the conversations that I didn't have with mm-hmm. patients because, you know, frankly, I didn't have the conversations because I didn't know what to say next. I could ask the first question, but I wouldn't know the second. Or if they did reveal something, I might not know how to treat it.
Yeah.
And I would feel so awful just, you know, saying, well, good luck with that. You know, mm-hmm. hope you do all right.
Or where do you send them? You
and
know?
Where, yeah. And that, yeah, that's where I know you and I kind of started collaborating on so many mm-hmm. Because I knew I didn't have the knowledge and the resources to help them, but I knew others did.
Yeah. And even those people that were properly trained, you know, again, the healthcare model is set up for 5 minutes, right? And you're supposed to do a full assessment, a workup, and 27 issues all in the same 5-minute visit, and it's impossible to have even just this one conversation about menopause management in mm-hmm. 5 minutes, nonetheless deal with a well woman visit and other things at the same time. So unfortunately, those that were properly trained weren't capable of incorporating that type of conversation properly into that visit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As you work with ladies, maybe even considering maybe new patients you see, what are some of the misconceptions or myths, so to speak, that they might bring into the office that you really have to break down consistently? And we'll kind of start there as kind of a myth-busting segment, mm-hmm. because I know that'll lead into a lot of different areas of conversation.
How much time you got?
Yeah.
So myths associated with women's health. Number one, pain is not normal, whether it's just general pelvic pain, vulvar pain, pain with sex. I think a lot of women are just so used to having, you know, menstrual cramps and things of that nature. And sure, it's not uncommon to have menstrual cramps, but when it's chronic pelvic pain or pain associated with genital structures or pelvic structures or pain with sex, that's not normal. And women should speak up. And if they receive the, have a glass of wine, or, just deal with it, or, put the same cream on that you've been prescribed 10 times that never worked before, and they're not getting proper answers, keep asking, keep seeking out those healthcare providers and those answers that you deserve, because there are answers out there.
Yeah.
Women's libido is the most women's low libido is the most common sexual complaint across the board in both men and women when it comes to sexual disorders. So when we think about sexual dysfunction, we think oftentimes about like Viagra and erectile dysfunction, especially working in urology, you know? So my current practice, and for 20 plus years, I was within a large urology practice, and I would always think about, you know, erectile dysfunction and Viagra and sildenafil and all of this. But really, when we break it down and we look at various surveys across the nation over, you know, decades, women's low libido is the most commonly reported complaint. And so it wasn't until 2015 that we finally got the first FDA-approved medication to treat low libido, which is called hypoactive sexual desire disorder.
Yeah.
So we now have two medications that are FDA approved. One is called Addy, and one is called Vyleesi. And so at least we're slowly crawling our way up to some, you know, level of common playing field, but we're still pretty far off.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Give me a topic and I'll give you a myth.
Yeah, well, I think actually that last one you mentioned is a great segue into a conversation I did want to have about libido.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the curiosities I had was, would you consider it normal for women to have a lower libido, a lower sex drive than men?
Mm-hmm.
Is would that be an accurate statement that should be the case, or is that a myth?
That's a good question. I really think it's individualized, but I think it's common for me to see in my clinic, at least. You know, obviously I see patients with problems usually associated with sexual functioning. It's not often that I have somebody come in to tell me how great their sex life is. You know, they don't usually need health care services for that purpose. But what I will say is that, yes, according to the surveys that I was just citing, women tend to report low libido more so than men. I think when we're talking about like a heterosexual couple, in general, men tend to have more of an innate need to release sexual tension. And so they're driven by this kind of physiologic desire for sex, whereas women tend to be more receptive creatures. And the best way I can kind of explain this to my patients, I'll say, you know, we don't tell ourselves to be hungry. It just kind of happens. You know, we're just sitting there and all of a sudden we realize our stomach's growling, or we're just feeling a little bit hungry and that sandwich over there looks really good. You know, that's kind of how sex is when we're talking about the wiring for men in general, and not always, not every man, but in general. For women, there tends to be more of a receptive aspect to it. So for instance, while a woman may not necessarily like crave sex or pursue it overtly, you know, with a male partner, maybe there are some subconscious cues, there are compliments, there are kind pats on the back, there are there's laundry that was done. Hint, hint, you know, anybody listening, you know, just anything that is like a love language, as people like to say, that can be a cue of sorts that might cause a processing in the brain, in the limbic part of the brain, that allows the woman to receive those cues. The body responds subconsciously, so physiologic arousal that happen triggers the brain to process that and allows, if the woman's receptive, to then go, I'm aware something's happening to my body and I want to continue this. Then the desire happens. So like all of this stuff has to happen before the desire occurs. It can happen very quickly, so it might feel spontaneous, but it's usually more of a receptive type of aspect.
Yeah.
So it makes sense why or how more problems can arise in that very complicated pathway versus this, like, I call it the light switch phenomenon of men.
Well, that's a great reminder that really for men and women both, sexual health is more than just one body system. It's not just the reproductive system. It's emotional, it's cerebral, it's chemical, it's hormonal, and it's going to affect the whole body. And there's going to be a process that happens, like you referenced, you know, in general, different for men and women. But that was, you know, a point you made earlier that's really surprising to me is that it's more common for ladies to report low libido than for gentlemen. And I think that is a good point to bring out, because I know gentlemen will often bring up maybe erectile dysfunction, but that is often independent of their libido. And for ladies, maybe that common complaint is the libido. So let's talk a little bit about the HSDD, the hypoactive sexual desire disorder, if I got that right.
Very good. I'm
impressed. So when should that be suspected? When should a lady kind of feel like, hey, I might need to bring these symptoms up because this may be something that has a treatment and is not considered, you know, just normal for me?
Anytime there's a bother associated with it. So for instance, I may have a patient that I'm assessing for sexual complaints, and we'll discuss, you know, do you have a low sex drive? Yes. Okay, well, explain to me when this began. Oh, well, when my partner had major surgery after a car accident, well, okay, you know, that explains what may be going on. And they anticipate that when things get back to normal, that will no longer be an issue. That's what we call situational. And it may not be overly distressing because they're focused on the healing and the medical concerns associated with their partner. That's a random example, but it kind of explains it.
Yeah.
Not all low libido is hypoactive sexual desire disorder. Mm-hmm. There's a symptom and there's a condition. The condition is what we treat with medications and so forth when you rule all the other causes out. Now, if I have a patient that comes to me and she says, I've always had a strong sex drive, or I used to have a stronger sex drive, and I used to be more receptive to my partner's advances, or I used to, you know, desire to get out and date more often or be more sexually active in general, and now something's changed. If I often hear that, I feel like a light switch went off. It's bothering me. I want to have sex more. That's what I hear a lot as well.
Yeah.
That tells me that something has changed. And if we kind of go through the list of possible aspects or possible causes for that, and we can't really identify a clear cause or clear identifying contributing, like instigating factor, in that case, I will say, well, let's maybe try either a hormone or one of the medications I mentioned earlier, such as Addy or Vyleesi, or a supplement, in some cases, like an evidence-based supplement that may help as well. And we'll go from there.
Yeah. So let's talk about maybe starting a, we'll save the medicine conversation for a few minutes, but let's talk about other methods of treatment. For a lady who comes to you and you feel like, okay, this is a change.
Yeah.
It's associated with a bother. This falls under that category of the HSDD. Mm-hmm. Where do you begin in terms of correction?
Yeah.
For that?
Well, for sure. It's a comprehensive treatment protocol and very holistic. So rarely do I just rely upon medication, you know. Almost always I'm going to suggest adding in a partner in crime, which I myself am not a sex therapist, but I encourage bringing in a counselor, a therapist, a sexuality educator, somebody in that realm of things, because I feel like, I always say, I feel like every woman should have a pelvic floor physical therapist and a sexuality, you know, counselor or therapist. You can't go wrong having a mental health counselor.
Yep.
And when there's sexual problems that have arisen, regardless of the cause, even if there is a very clear physiologic explanation, it's never a bad idea to have an unbiased person that is properly trained to talk through those issues, whether it's with the individual alone or with the couple or the dynamic in which it's impacting, so that they can not only help to address the issues that it's causing, but also to come up with tricks and techniques to mitigate some of those problems, in addition to what I'm providing from a more medicinal standpoint.
Great. Any supplements, natural remedies, anything maybe for people even to avoid that could affect their libido?
Yeah, for sure. Supplement wise, I do actually use, there's a product called Ristella that I use from the company Bonafide, and it's R-I-S-T-E-L-A. I don't endorse it or anything necessarily, but I do like that particular product because it does have some evidence behind it. Whereas, you know, unfortunately, in the supplement world, there's unfortunately not a lot of evidence behind products. You have to be really careful. And we all know you can go to the gas station and find all kinds of like horny goat weed stuff. And my patients, Lord knows what sawdust they're putting in their bodies. Most of it has zero evidence behind it, unfortunately. And these celebrities will get behind these products and endorse the heck out of them. And you just have to be really careful. So I try to really minimize what I feel comfortable giving my patients. But that is one. They market that more for like sexual enjoyment and pleasure. But while it works more on the nitric oxide pathway for blood flow, kind of like how Viagra works for men, it takes a while for it to build up in the system, 2 to 4 weeks or so. But once that begins to happen, if you think about it, then that pathway about it triggering the brain to become aware that something's happening on a more conscious level, it inevitably can benefit that desire piece of things.
So it kind of sounds like it kind of lowers the threshold to introduce that cycle, that arousal. Interesting.
And then anything that suppresses or suppresses dopamine in the brain or enhances serotonin. Serotonin's great for mood, but not so great for sexual functioning. Primarily orgasm, but also libido in both men and women. And so there's a lot of mood stabilizers and other medications that act on the central nervous system. So that's one of the first things that I'll go through, you know, like what medications are you on? Did you happen to start something or stop something right around the time that this all started? And oftentimes we'll find a contributing or correlating cause there. Occasionally we'll find that there's like a major dietary change or exercise change or like major stress-induced shift. You know, maybe there was a big move, maybe there's a job change or a divorce or something. And that seemed to correlate with the onset of sexual complaints. And so we'll consider that, and not just the emotional, but the downstream effect on our chemistry that happens oftentimes with such massive stress-induced triggers.
Yeah, yeah. This question will be very out of order, but when you mentioned serotonin, I was thinking of the often used medications, either the SSRIs or SNRIs, that can have the sexual side effects. In that realm, when those medications are indicated for another diagnosis, which ones do you feel like affect sexual health less than others from your experience?
That's a really tricky question, because it depends upon what the main symptoms are for the patient involved. You know, obviously the straight SSRIs are going to be definitely more impactful than the SNRIs. Anything, you know, like norepinephrine, dopamine enhancing is going to be a little bit better. So sometimes I'll even add a little bit of like Wellbutrin or bupropion in with an SSRI if a patient is stable and happy with their mood stabilizer. So let's say a patient's on Prozac or generic Prozac fluoxetine. I may go ahead and add in some bupropion to kind of counterbalance, you know, if they have no contraindications. And Addy, ironically, is a medication that it's not indicated for this. I want to be clear about that. But it's the medication that's indicated for HSDD, and there's no contraindication to taking that with an SSRI, even though they both work on the central nervous system. So sometimes I'll off-label use the Addy to counteract what I suspect may be HSDD that was induced by a medication.
That's great. That's great advice. That's all. Whenever I'm, you know, discussing those medications with individuals, it's always a barrier of entry. And sometimes you can tell, gentlemen and ladies both, they kind of check out once I kind of counsel them on the risk of sexual side effect. They're like, not for me
anymore. Waking and sexual side effects.
Yeah, two big deal breakers.
Yeah. So,
well, let's move into that conversation on Addy and Vyleesi. When do you recommend those? What's the difference between the two? And just kind of guide me through that thought process.
There's really no right or wrong. I'm very comfortable prescribing both of those medications. The side effect profile is very clean, in my opinion, compared to, I mean, gosh, even when we think about Viagra. Let's take a second to talk about that. So Viagra was approved in a, you know, 6-month expedited, you know, trial and or FDA approval process, whereas Addy, it took 10 years to get it approved. And it was just, it's almost laughable when you look at the side effects of sleepiness, you know, because it works in the central nervous system, like a lot of medications that we commonly prescribe every single day. So you just dose it at bedtime, no big deal. There's really, they've done a driving study the next day, so there's really no major concern for, you know, women driving off the road or anything the next day. It tends to, that effect of that kind of sleepiness tends to wear off. So after a couple of weeks, even that dosing or dose-dependent sleepiness is not so much an issue. There used to be a concern with drinking alcohol with it. That was mostly of a concern before the company was able to complete their binge drinking trials. They have since completed those, which I don't know how you find people to complete those trials. but they really did not find any significant interactions with alcohol and Addy. And so unless you're going to be, you know, drinking 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 plus drinks, you know, let's say it's a special party night, they, you know, it's fine to consume moderate amounts or small and moderate amounts of alcohol. But if you're going to be drinking 2+ alcoholic beverages in one sitting, they just say don't take your Addy that particular night, which is a common warning that you'll see on anything that acts on the central nervous system. So those are the main concerns with Addy. Then Vyleesi, the biggest side effect is nausea. So it's a self-administered injection. So instead of taking a pill every single day, which is what Addy is, Vyleesi is an injection. And they both work on the central nervous system for HSDD. It's just Addy has to build up in your system. Vyleesi is an injection that works in about 45 minutes. So after about 45 minutes, it kicks into a different system or a different pathway. Biggest side effect, like I mentioned, is nausea. And in about 40% of women, they will get some nausea, which is a pretty big percentage. What's ironic is it tends to usually only occur with the first injection for whatever reason. And it either doesn't occur as very, very minimal with the subsequent injections. And It usually only occurs for like, you know, a couple of hours if it does occur at all. So okay. I usually instruct my patients that are concerned about that to dose their first injection, the very first time they try it, at bedtime. Even though they don't recommend necessarily dosing it at bedtime,
yeah,
do the first shot, go to bed. It can last up to, you know, 16 hours or so, if not longer. Some okay. of my patients say even 24 hours. So if they dose an injection at bedtime, go to bed. If they have nausea, no big deal. They're sleeping it off. They wake up the next morning, they have the whole next day to enjoy the effect of the products.
Mm, gotcha.
I had a patient today that was like, give me the kitchen sink. And so she wanted to try Addy. And while she's waiting for Addy to kick in, she's going to intermittently dose the Vileci. She's also going to start Ristella, the supplement. And so she wanted to do the whole trifecta of things. And then we're also, if that doesn't work, we might add in some testosterone too, which we can talk about here shortly as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, she's just really eager to see improvement. Now, the downfall of doing everything all around at the same time is you don't know what's really working.
Yeah.
She's like, I don't care. Yeah. I just want to be better, you know.
Yeah. And at least she was forthright.
Exactly. And as long as there's no, you know, contraindications or interactions or whatnot, which in this particular case there weren't, I'm very comfortable with that.
Yeah.
And I'll just stay on top of her, maybe see her, or I'll stay on top of her case and see her a little bit more frequently than I would maybe somebody that I'm just doing one thing at a time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How about access to these meds, cost and coverage? You know, I know it's the Viagra conversation for gentlemen, which I do hate to hyper-focus on that. There's so many other agents that can be used besides Viagra. But before that went generic and became much cheaper, it was not covered by insurance, kind of considered a lifestyle med.
Right.
Insurance wouldn't cover it. Is that the same for Addy and Vileci?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The good thing about it, the companies that that own both Addy and Vileci partnered with specialty pharmacies. So they're separate pharmacies. Both of them, and I'm not sure at the timing of this podcast exactly which pharmacies they will have, you know, have a connection with, so I don't want to screw that up. But basically, specialty pharmacies, and instead of using a coupon, like we're very used to having a prescription, going to the pharmacy and handing a coupon or like pulling something up on our phone. Well, nowadays, a lot of these kind of subspecialty medications, they'll use specialty pharmacies that are more well-versed in the medication and they have more access to them. They have more availability. And so I send the prescription to these specialty pharmacies. They get the prescription. We run a prior authorization if needed. And then the pharmacy will cap the cost, assuming that the patient's insurance does not cover that particular medication. Addy, I believe, last I checked, was around $100 a month if there's no coverage whatsoever. So that's the maximum that the patient should pay if they meet the criteria, which means that they have a diagnosis of HSDD. And I also completely forgot to mention a very important point of Addy, which is it's indicated for premenopausal women with HSDD.
Okay.
And that's a big caveat. I prescribe it in women of all ages because we do have studies to show that it can work in all ages. Mm. And in Canada, it's actually approved for, or we know in other countries that these medications are approved for women of all ages.
Gotcha.
So I'll just throw that out there.
Yeah, well, that's good to know. I know sometimes there are those kind of technicalities of sorts that, you know, every country does their own thing differently. And so you can run into that, like, hey, in Europe, it's, you know, cleared, but not here.
Exactly.
So an anticipated time that will become the case here, I would say.
Yeah, I hope. I hope. It's been a while.
Although
we
hard.
Still don't see
yeah.
that, but I do prescribe it for all ages.
Yeah.
It's just the coverage piece of things. So
gotcha.
Sometimes they'll kick back and insurance will kick back and say this is not covered because she's postmenopausal or because she doesn't meet the exact criteria. And in that case, and the cap should be right around $100. Now, last I checked, I think that they offer, if you buy 2 months, you get one free. So they have little deals and things. So,
okay.
I think if you meet the criteria, I think it can be as cheap as $20, if I'm remembering correctly, $20 a month. And then Vileci, something similar, like right around, you know, $20 to $100, depending upon insurance coverage.
Gotcha.
Okay.
That's great. And as you say those, my mind goes toward, okay, Addy, a little more consistent, kind of works in your system, Vileci as needed.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever counsel the anticipated relief that ladies will feel from Addy being more consistent as opposed to kind of having, in a way, do ladies have to kind of get into that thought of like, oh, I'm not really in the mood, but I want to be.
Yeah.
Take a shot. Is it more preventive and proactive to be on something like Addy versus Vyleesi, or am I thinking about it the
wrong
way? No,
you're absolutely right. That's why I like to kind of see what my patients' goals are and how they feel about the kind of what their headspace is, I guess, is a way of saying it, because every woman is so radically different, and some women are horribly embarrassed, you know, by their symptoms. They shouldn't be. By no means should they feel embarrassed, but they kind of want to keep this discreet. They don't even want to talk to their partner about this. So doing a shot right before sex is not exactly the most discreet thing. And so in that case, doing a daily pill that they can just like throw in their pill pack and just kind of take on a daily basis, out of sight, out of mind, might be better for them. Whereas the patient that doesn't want to have to take a daily pill, they're not on a bunch of daily medications, they don't want to have to sign up for something that they're committed to every single day. That's where the injection can be super helpful. They're very comfortable and confident, you know, utilizing something. They have no needle phobia. And by the way, the needle is itty, itty, bitty. It's actually smaller than the EpiPen pediatric, you know, size needle. So it's tiny, tiny, tiny. And it's a pre-filled, you know, pen, so you never really actually see the needle. You just push it down like all the other injectable things that we see nowadays. But yeah, so if a woman's comfortable with that, it's easy. They're pretty easy to transport. You can take them on vacations and travel times. So sometimes women will use them during times when they know that they just have a little bit more downtime with their partner, and it's something to look forward to. And what they found in the clinical trials that even though on average women use the injections about four times a month, they were sexually active more than four times a month, which tells us that they were motivated to be sexually active even when they weren't using the pen. So it helped to kind of stimulate this enjoyable, you know, like experience that made them go, hey, that was fun, I want to do that again with or without the pen.
It kind of taps into the other aspects of sexual health. It's, you know, obviously, like we've said, there's a lot of layers to what can be a challenge and a barrier to having appropriate and good sexual health. And having, you know, symptoms like this. So as we transition into talking about perimenopause and ultimately kind of postmenopause, as we leave libido, should a lady expect to have a lower libido postmenopause?
Good question.
I don't know the answer. I'm really interested.
We see that women of all ages experience low libido. It's just there's a little bit of a transition of distress associated with it. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, you can have the symptom of low libido, but is it bothersome? Like, are you motivated to actually do something about it? Is it impacting your daily life? What we found is the area or the time frame in which there is distressing low sexual desire tends to be kind of that midpoint, you know, like 45 to 65 or so. Now there may be some more updated studies, but that's kind of what we can hang our hat on. But we do see low libido occurs in all ages for various reasons. It's the reasoning behind it that tends to vary. So maybe younger years, kind of lack of familiarity with, you know, erogenous zones or feeling comfortable within oneself or a new relationship, you know, getting to know your own body, nonetheless, another partner, and then how those two bodies interact with one another is a very complicated thing. Later on, bodies are changing. You know, there's other health conditions that get thrown into the mix, new medications, other life stressors, you know, kids going off to college. You know, there's a lot happening that oftentimes will just kind of burden your brain, to, especially in women, to distract you from being receptive to those sexual cues.
Yeah, that's a great reminder. Thank you for listening to this conversation. I truly hope you found it useful. You can find out more about today's episode and discover additional resources at BrentwoodMD.com. Be sure to check out all of our other content that we've created by searching BrentwoodMD on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. If our content has provided you with value, it would mean the world to us if you subscribed to the show and left a review. This helps us ensure that more people, just like you, can find our content so that they can begin optimizing their health. To learn more about our concierge services that we provide to our members, visit BrentwoodMD.com. We'd love to meet you. This podcast was for general information only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or giving of medical advice, as no doctor-patient relationship has been formed. The content of this podcast is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should seek the advice of their own trusted medical professional.